Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
All right. Hey, good morning again. My name is Kurt.
And my name is Sarah.
And we are excited. Our first ever co-teaching message that we've ever done. Very exciting. And so if you didn't know, Sarah and I are the two pastors here, right? Yeah,
that it's
just
us. Right. That's
just
good.
The two of us. I was fact-checking that. I'm just making sure. It's just the two of us. And so we haven't done this yet. And some of you may be asking, like, why now? Why is it happening now? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, Sarah does work with the kids and the students. And it was really important when we started this church to have excellent, excellent theological support for our kids. So we don't look at what happens downstairs as babysitting, because it's not. It's deep theological teaching and instruction, and we're building a community, and we wanted to have someone who is capable of doing that. So here's one thing. Sometimes in churches, when the person who's normally with kids and students comes upstairs, people are like, oh, like you graduated or you're coming up. No, Sarah is slumming it with us this morning and being up here. Because Sarah does amazing things downstairs, and part of the reason why it's now is Sarah is building these incredible volunteer teams where we're just now at the place where the ministry can operate without you, which is great. And also the topic that we're looking at is something that Sarah has done a lot of research and reading on and is passionate about. So we are excited, and I'm glad that you guys get the benefit of hearing from Sarah. But this isn't like a graduation. This is something different. This is just like we're excited to share it.
But you can give me graduation presents if you want. I'll take it. I'll accept it.
Cash money?
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to launch our series this week on shame. And Kurt and I normally work in 82nd and Johnson Creek Starbucks. So if you ever want to visit us, that's where we hang out because we don't have really an office. Yeah. And I was thinking through what we're talking through this morning with shame. And this feels like really not, like it's a really personal topic in a really impersonal room, right? It's like kind of weird that we're talking about something that's actually really, really specific, really vulnerable for us both. So if I could invite you into my office for a second at 82nd, Johnson Creek Starbucks. That's how I want to have the conversation with you this morning as we talk about shame. So I want to give you context on my story. Kurt and I started talking about like our own personal experiences of shame. And what I found was that there were stories that I had really pushed out of my mind. There are stories I didn't really want to talk about. They're like I had blocked a lot of those details. I think shame can do really powerful things, right? And then there were some that were very immediate. I knew it almost right away. I could tell you like, oh yeah, I wasn't doing well in that moment. So I'm going to share with you a story that only happened a couple years ago. So context, I was raised in a Mennonite Presbyterian family. So if you know anything about denominations, that's a really weird mix. And so I tell you that because I want you to know, like, I was a church kid, like, fully a church kid. Some of you, though, maybe were raised in more evangelical settings, or maybe you were reacting to, like, a purity movement, and that wasn't my story. That's not a part of my childhood. So I would describe my childhood. I was raised, my sister and I, with a preference towards modesty. But I wouldn't tell you that that was because Jesus told me I needed to be modest or there wasn't anything really biblically tied to that. It just was there and it existed, if that makes sense. And then you fast forward in my life and I started working at a non-denominational church and I was a youth pastor at 21 years old. And suddenly I found that everyone seemed to mention what I looked like and what I was dressing like. And so some of that wasn't negative. Some of that had to do with you have long blonde hair. I had just gone to college in Southern California. And so it would be brought up a lot, like you're this Southern California girl, which I'm not. I'm from other places, right? Or I noticed that people would talk about my pants. How tight were my pants? Where was my shirt? Maybe I dressed too young. Some days they would say, man, you just look like one of the kids. It's so great. Or they would bring up, oh, you know, you don't look like you're 21, right? It was like this constant conversation to me of what I looked like and what I was matching up to be. So then you keep moving forward in time, and you go to where Kurt and I actually had the opportunity to lead a mission trip together in Kenya. So in college, you maybe have heard me reference, I lived in South Africa for a little bit. So I spent time on the continent. That's about as much as I can tell you there. And I was really excited, and I felt privileged to go back. And so when Kurt and I went, we were excited. And if you've done a long trip, you know, you're like really foggy that first day, like that jet lag, and you don't know where you are. You're kind of just like walking through time. And it was in that moment that we had a really important meeting about what all the rules were of our time in Kenya. And so the first thing that I remember, and I will admit to you, this is where all of my shame kind of starts kicking in, and it's where the story gets really hazy for me. And so I remember that we were talking about the rules and the different things, and there was a woman who's from the United States who was explaining to us modesty and the importance of modesty in Kenya as a Christian woman. And so she basically starts talking about modesty and then points out that I'm not modest enough to the entire room. And I'm supposed to be a pastor in that room and space, and I'm in charge of this trip with Kurt. And as I tell you this, I see your eyes right now, and I feel this need, this sense to defend to you what I was actually wearing. Because I feel like even as I tell you that, your response to me would be like, yeah, but look at her. She probably wasn't modest enough. She probably didn't do it. She didn't pull it off. So I'm going to tell you what I was wearing. I told you I was a church kid. I was raised in the church, and so I had my mission trip pants on, which were specific jeans that I only wore on trips, which that is a tough confession, right? Like, I had specific pants that I was going to wear in this foreign country, and I was wearing them. And then I was wearing a male white V-neck shirt, the kind that you guys get in packages for like $5 or something. And it wasn't like those like deep Vs. It was like a high V, right? There was not much being shown. And there was a tank top. There was like all the things. And I remember sitting there, and I didn't hear anything else that they said to me. There were things I needed to hear. I was supposed to be like in charge of this space with Kurt. And I didn't hear anything else. All I heard was, you're disgusting. Your body's nasty. If they only knew how gross your body was, they would never let you be a pastor.
And what was shocking in being there is I was wearing the exact same thing. Like, I'm wearing my mission trip jeans. I'm a church kid who grew up there. Like, you have the jeans that you put up in the closet. Like, these are for mission trips. I'm wearing that. And I never walked into that room thinking that anyone was going to point me out or say anything about what I was wearing and that that would be causing people to stumble. So we know when we talk, we go into this, and I want to share a story from my past where I experienced that. One of the things that we know when we talk about a message series and we talk about shame is some of you are like there. You're like, yes, I get it. But for some of you, you're like, I don't really deal with shame. It's not a thing or an emotion or experience that I have very often. And so when we talk about this, one good way to do that, if you can't locate the moments where you experience shame, a good way is to track back reactions you have in different circumstances, because they can be linked to shame. So if you've ever been called out for something that you did wrong or something that happened, and you feel one of three responses, you feel a desire to escape, to blame someone else, or to defend yourself, these are shame responses. And we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. But normally, when you try to escape, defend, you're trying to deflect, you're trying to blame someone else, these are where you've taken the thing that you're being called out and you've internalized it, where you're defending yourself. So my experience is a number of years ago. I was working at a Christian camp. If you haven't picked up the thread of our two stories, Christian communities do shame really, really well.
The best.
And one of the things one of the ways that you can find shame is actually when you get called out at something that you think you do well. You're like, this is something I'm good at. Because when people are like, hey, Kurt, you showed up late. I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm not proud of that, but it's happened with enough frequency that it's not surprising. Like, it doesn't take me off guard. But one of the things I pride myself is I feel like I can make people comfortable around me. People don't feel scared or intimidated or threatened in any way. And so I was at working at this Christian camp. It was in our first week of meeting. We were talking to all kinds of people. I love meeting and talking with people, and like new people is just like the best. I love it. So I was going around, and the head of the women's head counselor pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Kurt. So another one of the female staff members came to me and complained about an inappropriate joke that you had made that made her feel really unsafe." And I immediately wanted to fall into the ground and disappear. I didn't want to be in that space at all. And one of the reasons why it was so hard for me, it was this unnamed floating person out there that I had deeply offended. So I didn't have the opportunity to make amends. And it was like, what did I say? And like, we don't really want to get into the thing that you said. You just need to be really aware of your words and how you choose to use them. So something that I said to someone created this unsafety for them. And I got physically ill. I didn't go to like the rest of the night or having a dinner and all that. I went to my room and I cried in my room. And I was like, I shouldn't be here. I am an unsafe person. I'm dangerous. I'm hurtful. Why would anyone want to be friends with me when I create these things? And it was this deep spiral that got worse and worse and worse. And so as we share these stories, hopefully we want you not just to be able to hear our stories, but to identify where are moments of shame in your own story, because it's going to be really helpful to track that as we go through the rest of the message.
So before we start looking at a story in Genesis, we want to go ahead and take a second and just pause and define the phrases that we're talking through. So the first kind of important thing to understand is the difference between shame and guilt. If you've read anything on Brené Brown, who has made shame and guilt be kind of honestly popular phrases in the last 5 to 10 years, you know that shame is the concept where you say, "I am bad." So that idea of like, "I'm disgusting." Not what I'm wearing is disgusting, I am gross. Like, it's like this like, ugh, that feeling, that is shame, right? And then guilt is this concept of that what I did was bad, right? And so something that we kind of want to differentiate as Kurt and I were chatting through this pretty quick off the bat is that we realize that guilt is a part of our conscience that is important, right? When I do something and now I've just hurt someone, there are times where I'm going to feel guilt. And that's an important part of our experience of how we interact with humanity, right? There's something within our conscience that says that wasn't right. I need to go make amends, or maybe I should do this differently next time. Shame, though, is different because it's not a process where you're able to take that kind of sidestep, whatever the next step through that process. Shame kind of holds us captive, right? Shame is the thing that won't let us go. And so some kind of basic things around shame, right? We know that everyone experiences shame. If you love the Enneagram like me, and if you don't know about it, that's fine. But there's 9 numbers. And within the Enneagram, numbers 2, 3, and 4 are known to have more tendencies towards a shame reaction. I'm a 2. Isn't that great? But I want you to hear that all of those other numbers still experience shame. And so your goal is not, am I experiencing shame or not? That's not what we're looking at. We're asking, are you able to identify the triggers in your life when you respond out of shame? Can you recognize it? Can you even be able to say, oof, I think this might be a shame response? So shame asks the questions at its core. Do you love me? Do you care about me? Do you see me? Am I important? Right? You might be saying other things out of your mouth, but those are the questions that you're asking behind the things, right? And I think what's so important about those questions, and in some of us, we prod, right? Like, I'm like asking questions, and what I'm really asking that person is, but do you love me still? Are we still okay, right? And I'm like asking question after question, I'm prodding. And others of us just blow up. Others of us shut down. Shame affects us all really differently. So we all experience shame. The other thing I want to hit on with shame and guilt is sometimes we've been around kind of a culture that says this phrasing of like, God told me so, which I don't want to claim to be bad. But I think when someone says that phrasing, it holds a lot of power. So if I say to someone, God told me whatever, it's hard to argue that because I don't know someone else's experience with God, right? And I give you that connection because just as that phrase, I think, needs to be said and held with the power and delicacy of that statement, I think when we start claiming that we're experiencing shame, it does something really similar. So if we start to be able to communicate and use this language, I'm experiencing shame. But in fact, perhaps it's guilt, right? That's something you can't argue. I can't argue if your experiences in your life and your triggers are shame or guilt. So I want to just, as we're using these words, use them really cautiously when we're using them and how we're using them. And then the other side of shame and guilt is love and belonging. So love and belonging goes with shame because it's kind of the thing that counters shame. If I know that I am loved, if I know that I belong, right, that's the thing that counters that feeling of I shouldn't be here, I'm disgusting, I'm gross. Right? So it's a really important thing. Just as much as we know we all experience shame, we all experience this desire for love and belonging. They're both true. And we know that shame will never go away. We can start to have conversations around it, but it won't leave. Your goal is to identify. Love and belonging also won't go away. That's a desire we have within us.
So some of you right now are tracking. You're like, yes, this is good. I'm glad we're having this conversation. Some of you might be like, so this is Christmas message? We're doing this for Christmas? Here's the reason is as we were looking at this, and we're going to look at a story that kind of exposes these different parts of it. So much of the conversations that we've had about Jesus has come to deal with our guilt, the stuff we've done wrong. So in Christian language, the sin is really important, that there's this stuff that exists that Jesus came to deal with. But what we don't always talk about is, but Jesus came to also address our shame. And so that's why we want to look at shame, Christmas through the lens of shame, to say, how has Christ come to undo that thing? Not just the stuff you've done, but how you feel about who you are and how you feel about the actions, how you engage in it. Because if we don't unlock that thing, as we've talked about, shame has all these different responses and reactions. All of those different responses and reactions block us from becoming the people God created us to be. We're not living into who God created us to be if we're reacting and responding. Does that make sense? So God created us to know that we are loved and that we belong so that we can live into who we've been created to be and we can share that love and belonging with those that are around us. We can try harder, we can have more rules, we can create higher expectations for your code of conduct and behavior, but if we don't unlock shame, you're constantly going to be reacting out of that. So what we want to do is we want to walk through one story of the Bible to say, where do we see guilt, where do we see shame, where do we see love and belonging? So we got really creative, and we started at Genesis 1. So we're going to look at the story of Adam and Eve. And the first thing to note is, so if you brought your Bible with you, I encourage you to turn and pull up the beginning of Genesis. We're going to start in Genesis 1:31. 1:31, so there's this creation story where God is going through and creating different things. And we're going to capture it right here in 1:31. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. There's this repeated theme throughout the story that when God has created something, it is very good. This is important when we know the baseline of who we are is good. We stray from that. We get away from that. We do things that counteract that. But who we are and how we've been created to be is good and beautiful and right. The question is, how do we find that? How do we discover that? How do we let God open that picture up? Now, if you're familiar with the story, God creates Adam and Eve. And in this, when we look at 2:25, there's this really kind of beautiful little verse when it says, after God's created them, Adam and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. Adam and his wife were naked and they felt no shame. So we are excited to announce the first ever nudity church in Portland, Oregon. Right? I'm just kidding. this gets into, again, the creation that God made us for is without shame. When we experience these things, and we're going to look at where this takes root in, where we have the shame linked to who we are, our bodies, this isn't created to how God made us to be. This isn't how God created us. It's an experience that we took on in ourselves. We were created to operate without shame. And that's right there at the beginning of the story. So we're going to look at Genesis 3, and this is where we're going to dive in a little bit more. Adam and Eve have this whole Garden of Eden to hang out in, to party in, to do all kinds of fun things. God says, hey, there's this one tree. Don't eat of the tree. And we see that the serpent has something to say about this in Genesis 3, 4, and 5. You will not certainly die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So there's this one tree they're not supposed to eat from. They're hanging out by the tree like you do. And the serpent starts talking to them. What the serpent is addressing is the serpent is creating shame. Who you are and how you've been created to be actually isn't good enough. There's something better here at the tree. When you eat from this tree, your eyes are going to be opened. And one of the fundamental lies that we can believe is God's holding out on you. The things within Christian community that we say, hey, these aren't God's best. This isn't the way that people who live in like a gospel-centric life or the way that we talk about, these aren't the people that are living for the kingdom of God live. The lie is like, yeah, but God's kind of holding out on me, right? There's something better. There's another experience that's better out there that I need to explore and that I need to see because this isn't enough or this isn't good enough or I'm not complete without fill in the blank. Ultimately, that comes down to identity and taking on, you should, as Adam and Eve, the serpent is saying, you should be ashamed of who you are. It's not enough. But when you eat of this fruit, then you will be enough. So as we continue on in verses 8 and 9 in the story, then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man, where are you? We talked about when we're experiencing shame, our response can be hiding, escaping, blaming, or deflecting. When they hide, Adam and Eve are hiding, not because they had this thing that like, hey, no, we need to take responsibility for this thing that we did that's wrong. They have taken it on to their person. We need to go hide because we are wrong. Does that make sense? When you experience something as guilt, and Sarah's definition to, I've done something bad, I've done something wrong, then you can take responsibility for the action because it doesn't compromise who you are, and you can make amends. You can apologize, you can rectify that behavior. But when you're dealing with shame, you take the action into identity, and one of the key responses is to go hide, and this is what Adam and Eve do. Now, Adam really, he gets at the shame issue from all kinds of issues. So look at how he responds in verses 12 and 13. This is Adam talking to God. The man said, the woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. Now, it's one sentence, but man, that is a lot of blaming going on. So what did you do, Adam? What's the action activity that you did? He can't identify the action because it would be too costly as to who he is. So he says, the woman, right now, we have the serpent. There's only four characters, and Adam's already blamed half of them. The woman you put here, she gave me the fruit and offered it to me. And you notice this when people are dealing and responding to shame, sometimes it's blaming, but sometimes the tactic we just go to instinctively is confusion. Let's just bring enough other people into this situation so that we can all agree it probably wasn't me, right? I mean, there was traffic, and there's this thing with the kids this morning, and then, well, you know, all these people moving to Portland, right? There's enough other factors that we can pull into the situation, and this is what Adam is doing because he's not acknowledging it's something that he did. It's something that he is. He is feeling and experiencing this as shame and not guilt. So from the very beginning of the story, we see that shame is incredibly important. And as we want to look at now, this isn't something that we're like, hey, Jesus came to deal with this. We actually have stories from the life of Jesus that deal with that.
Yeah, so kind of what we talked about is more of a concept we've heard with Jesus is like, he's here for my guilt, and then he died on the cross. Kind of that's like the process. And while I'm not going to sit here and argue what he did or didn't come for, I would say, and your shame, like, and that piece too. And we see that in the Bible, in the scriptures. And so Kurt and I started chatting about like our favorite shame stories. It kind of felt like within the Bible, because they're not ours, they're somebody else's. And the one that I really like, I don't even know if that makes sense now, but I really like the story of the woman that's caught in adultery, right? And I love that story because you get introduced into an honor and shame culture. Like, you're one or the other in Bible times. Like, that's like the main emphasis of the story. And so you're invited into the story in John where you see like a trial. Basically, it's happening in the temple, right? And they've come and they're telling Jesus how this woman is guilty, right? But they're not talking about her guilt, because if she was guilty, there would be two people. It's adultery. It's not just her. It can't just be her that's guilty. There has to be two. And so that clues us in instead that this is actually a story about shame, I think, that they are trying to shame this woman. They're not trying to prove her guilt, right? And they're trying to show what she's done is shameful. And the other piece of the story, what I love, is then Jesus is also, they're also trying to prove that Jesus is guilty or shameful. Like, I'm not quite sure which one, but they're also trying to trick Jesus in experience of shame. How are you going to respond? What are you going to do? We know what should happen. We know what the Bible says, right? We know what the Torah says, not the Bible. But then the final piece of the story, what I love, this is my favorite part, is that Jesus doesn't just say, like, you got it, you're okay, right? That's not what happens in the story. He reinstates her back into her community, right? He counteracts a story and message of shame, and he says, you belong here. Go back into your community. She's been told you don't belong, and he's saying, I love you, right? I'm here. He doesn't say those words, but that's what I imagine. I imagine Jesus being like, no, go back, go live your life. You've been reinstated back in.
And it's amazing there that Jesus says, the words that he uses, I don't condemn you. Where are your accusers? Then I don't condemn you. And even in the Christian story, it's interesting when he says, like, well, the person without sin throw the first stone. And you're like, oh, all right, good one, Jesus. You got everybody on a technicality. In fact, the Christian teaching about Jesus is that actually there was someone at the scene that was without sin. So Jesus has the ability to condemn, but he doesn't, because he's looking to reinstate and let people know that you are loved and you belong. Another story that we want to look at is about a man named Zacchaeus. How would you describe him? Like a wee little man?
I think he might be tall.
Tall? A giant? Zacchaeus the giant. Probably Nephilim. Look it up. So Zacchaeus, I apologize. That's a very churchy joke. We can talk about it later. It's hilarious. Zacchaeus, a little guy who's hanging out and Jesus is walking through, but he's a tax collector. We talked a lot about tax collectors, but they are deeply hated. So hated that a number of times in the stories about Jesus, Jesus gets acclaimed of you hang out with sinners and tax collectors, because it's another framework of sinners. Like, sinner doesn't cover. There's like sinners and tax collectors. It was something that you could feel incredible guilt for doing, because you are turning your back on your people, the Israelite people, to collect taxes on behalf of the Roman government. So you're betraying your own people to make a profit. And here's something that's really interesting about shame. One thing that makes it difficult for us to experience something and just to feel guilty about something is if it's a repeated behavior day after day after day. Zacchaeus would have to change everything about his life if he was to experience his tax collecting as something he was guilty of, which is robbing and taking money from his own people for his personal benefit. But because he's doing it every single day, this thing has gone deep. It is who he is at this point. So he's looking for Jesus. He's looking to see Jesus. He climbs up in the tree. And Jesus, which is beautiful, is Jesus responds not with, "Hey, we all know you're super guilty of robbing people. Return everybody's money, and then I'll have dinner at your house." Jesus leads with, "Hey, Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house today. I'm having dinner." Which, for us, we're like a little presumptuous. Probably should RSVP first. Don't just invite yourself over. But what Jesus is doing is he's taking someone who's on the outskirts of the community and he's making them central. This is now my host, which a host in their culture was one of the most honored positions you could have. You are loved, you are seen, and you belong. Now, what's fascinating is Jesus isn't trying to deal with this behavior, but through love and belonging, knowing that he is okay, what's interesting is you can almost see the shame melt and the right amount of guilt to come into the picture, because what Zacchaeus says at the end of the meal is, "I realize what I've done is wrong. I'm not going to collect taxes like this anymore, and I'm going to return the money back to the people." He doesn't say, "I am wrong, I did this." Through Jesus' love and belonging, not dealing with his guilt, but dealing with his shame, we see this whole story and this whole narrative shift and change. It's pretty beautiful.
So our hope this morning is that we'd be able to walk away as a community, and we would first be able to talk about what we know and understand to be shame, and that what we know to understand to be guilt. And my own personal hope, honestly, is as a community, I hope we would be able to recognize how we're experiencing that, when we're being triggered by that, and we'd be using the right word, right? Not using the one that could be the word of power or of detriment. And then on the flip side, my hope is that we would then, in return, understand love and belonging, right? We all believe we belong in different places. Some of us, church is a place where we feel like we belong. I understand that for some of us, that's not at all how we feel. What would it look like to believe you belonged at Cascade? Right? And I think one of the key components of love and belonging is we're asking people to understand, like, you belong here, but, like, we don't believe we belong in our own bodies. Right? We don't actually believe we belong within ourselves. And so I think like this first step in believing you belong anywhere, whether it be here or another space, is like, do you love you? Are you even comfortable with that concept? I think we've twisted and turned the Bible in so many ways that we can't even say how great we are sometimes. Brené Brown has this awesome quote. I'm going to read it to you guys. It says, "If we're going to find our way out of shame and back to each other, vulnerability is the path and courage is the light." So we're going to ask this morning, just like we were vulnerable, to do kind of an activity that takes some vulnerability and takes some courage. And it's going to be really uncomfortable for you and I both. I'm just going to own it for you. And so it's called Pass the Pride. Ready? Like that? Some people know like Pass the Peace if you're that church kid. It's Pass the Pride. That's what we're doing. So what's going to happen is I'm going to ask if you will, you guys should see your faces right now. You're like, nope, sir. I'm going to ask, and I work with middle school and high schoolers, so I'm going to ask firmly, if you will go ahead and grab your bulletin or whatever the Cascade thing is. There you go. That thing, your Cascade card, I would ask, would you take a minute while I'm talking, do it over top of me, and I want you to write down the 3 to 5 things that you are awesome at, that you were made and created to be, because we know that each of us are unique, and we want to celebrate that. And so here's why I'm asking you to celebrate that. I'm asking you to recognize within yourself one thing that you were created for. I mean, I'm asking 3 to 5 because it can be hard. So what's going to happen is I'm going to have you stand up. And if you don't know the person that you're by, I'm going to ask that you introduce yourself. So it would be like this. I would say, "Hi, Kurt. My name is Sarah. So good to meet you." And then I would say the thing that I'm good at. I'm passing my pride. So I would say, "Kurt, I'm good at being consistent." And then Kurt would then introduce himself.
"Hi, I'm Kurt. I'm a good dad."
Good dad. Look at that. And we could just like high five it off. Done. That's all you have to do. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to high five. You don't even have to even really touch after that handshake, but it might be a nice, like, closure, you know? I found when we did this with random strangers at this event we went to, I found that what was interesting is once someone said that they were good at it, I wasn't like looking at them being like, no, you're not that good of a dad, right? Like, I'm not questioning their ability. Instead, I wanted to be like, tell me about your kids. What are their names? What do you love doing with them? For me, it really sparked like tons of interest that this person was able to recognize something that they were good at. So I hope you've written a few things down. I'm going to ask you to stand up, even if you haven't. That's your time to stand up. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm going to ask, will you take the next 2 minutes? You're not stopping at one. You're just going. Going until we close you. Will you introduce yourself and let someone know something you're great at?
Go.